Welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis, and joining us today on the program is Scott Rabb. He has a new book out. It's called The Whore of Akron, One Man's Search for the Soul of LeBron James. Welcome to the program, Scott.
Hey, thanks for having me, Vic.
Scott, readers of the November issue of Esquire magazine got a little foretaste of this book. There's a sampling of it in that edition. And you've been writing for Esquire for a while, haven't you?
Since 1997, so 15 years, coming up on 15 years.
And when this project began, it was a very different project, was it not?
I started the season before last, at the beginning of LeBron's last year with the Cavaliers, hoping to write the storybook version, the one with the happy ending, where the native son of northeastern Ohio leads the tribe to the promised land after almost 50 years of wandering in the desert.
Now, when you say tribe, hardcore Cleveland fans might think, what's he talking about, the baseball team? You're a long-suffering you're a long-suffering Cleveland guy, aren't you?
Yeah, I was born and raised there at a time when the Cleveland that I was born into was the seventh largest city in the country and a town that thought well of itself. And the teams, particularly the Browns, Cavs didn't exist then. The Indians had a proud history. They were about to enter the doldrums that lasted decades. The Browns were a great team, a paragon of excellence and consistency, a thriving middle class. It was a boom town in the sense that many of the Rust Belt cities were at that time. And so, you know, over the decades, it certainly wasn't just the sports teams. It was the whole spiral downhill that made us the fan base that we are today, for better and mostly for worse.
So you started off writing a book that was going to culminate with the glorious victory in the NBA Finals by the Cleveland Cavaliers. Then something happened.
A bunch of things happened en route to a 61 victory season that ended in the second round against the Boston Celtics. It wasn't any one thing. It was as with any sport, especially with basketball, where it's a long season. You know, things didn't go well. They never really do for most Cleveland teams, no matter how good things look at the beginning of the season or on paper. So by the time they lost to the Boston Celtics and LeBron famously ripped his jersey off on his way to the locker room after Game 6 of that series, things were pretty grim. But I didn't have a book deal at that point anyway. So for me, it was a year at sports journalism fantasy camp and another year of dashed hope as a Cleveland fan. And then I guess the town got horribly unlucky, the fan base got horribly unlucky, and as a guy who wanted to write a book, I guess I got lucky. LeBron made the decision the way he made the decision, and within a few weeks after that, I suddenly had a book deal with HarperCollins.
I remember watching him tear off his jersey, and the first thing that came to my mind, knowing his contract was up, was, that's it. He's done. No more Cleveland Cavaliers for LeBron James. But you didn't think that, did you? You believed.
Nah, I went back and forth. You know, it's so difficult to reconcile. When you're a fan, the heart and the head, and maybe for a Cleveland fan in particular, you want to always be optimistic. You want to impose the kind of narrative that leaves us all feeling good about ourselves and our town and our teams and all that stuff. So, yeah, I guess even up to the day of the decision, July 8th, 2010, I still harbored a sense of hope. I also was getting calls, got one from a guy, he's in the book, Joe Gabriel, works for the Cavaliers, great guy. He called me that day and said, don't worry, man. You know, LeBron, you know how when he goes down, it looks like he's broken his wrist or ankle and they're going to have to take him to the hospital immediately, but he gets up and he's fine? That's what this is. He's got everybody where he wants them. He wouldn't be taking an hour of prime time on ESPN just to drag all of northeastern Ohio, really millions of fans around the world who liked the story of the hometown hero. He wouldn't do that. He wouldn't do it. Don't worry. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I guess part of me still looks at that with a sense of, God, I wish the kid would have done the right thing.
Scott Rabb joins us. His book is The Whore of Akron, One Man's Search for the Soul of LeBron James. In the book, you describe when LeBron was still playing for Cleveland and you were in the locker room and you had a moment where you were able to walk up to him, just the two of you, and you said to him, that he was better than Michael Jordan. He was better than any of these great players. He was the best player you had ever seen.
I still believe it. And I mean, as ridiculous as it sounds now, and I know there's always been a contingent of fans who say, oh, count the rings. You know, this is what Yankees fans love to say if you disrespect Derek Jeter. Count the rings. There's certainly always been an argument against LeBron, and now more than ever, that when crunch time comes, he doesn't deliver. But I will say, especially when I said it to him, which was April of 2010, so it was before the playoffs started, and it was a moment in the locker room where I knew I was leaving. I wouldn't be back until early May when the playoffs began, where I wanted to say, I'm old enough to remember seeing Oscar Robertson play. I've seen them all, and you're the best basketball player I've ever seen. I wasn't trying to curry favor at the time. I was immensely frustrated because I'd spent week after week after week in Cleveland trying to work on the happy book and had never gotten a minute of official access to LeBron. It was simply a moment as a fan and as a guy who really has seen a whole lot of basketball to say, your game, and I mean the range of his skills, he should have won a third MVP award last year with the Heat. The range of his talents is unlike any players that I've ever seen in the NBA. I believed it then. I believe it now.
Do you think it would have maybe made a difference if you reached in your pocket and pulled out that talisman, that sacred ticket stub, and showed it to him?
No. I don't think anything would have made a difference. I don't know at any point what was really going on. I don't think anyone does. Certainly nobody in the media knows whether he was ever really happy being drafted by the Cavs, whether he really did feel some bond with the area and the fan base. You know, he always talked about knowing the history and understanding the hunger, and he wasn't going to go chasing championships. Certainly nothing any one person, one fat guy, you know, with a tape recorder pulling anything out of his pocket. Impossible to believe it would have made a difference. After all, when you think about it, he certainly understood at some level that by leaving he was inflicting a fairly severe emotional and to some degree economic wound on Northeastern Ohio. And ultimately, I don't think it mattered at all.
Well, the taxes are different, aren't they, in Ohio than in Florida? Wasn't it a better deal for him?
I think it was. I think there's been a lot of back and forth about that, and people who continue to claim that he took less money to go to Miami, forget about the fact there's no state income tax there. There's none whatsoever in Florida. And look, this is the strangest part of being a fan, is even for those of us who know enough to understand it's a business, and certainly anyone in the media knows it's a business, and any fan who doesn't after this recent lockout, my goodness, how naive can you be? And yet we still like to tell stories to ourselves and to each other. You know, these narratives about our heroes. They're simplified. They're two-dimensional at best. But it's one of the things that makes sports special. I mean, in some ways, sports is a fine art. It's like opera, sculpture, or anything like that. It can be transporting in the best sense. And at the same time, we sublimate a lot of our, especially in terms of our gender, you know, guys just, they find a lot of very visceral, primal, warlike, belligerent satisfaction in rooting for teams. But at a higher level, at an intellectual and a somewhat spiritual level, we like to tell stories about, hey, it's our Moses. My God, the tribe of Cleveland fans has wandered in the desert for nigh on, you know, half a century. Our Moses has arrived, and all that stuff, I think, does add meaning to the experience. Unfortunately for a Cleveland fan, the ending is always unhappy.
I know what you're talking about, Scott, and I just want you to know, since you can't see me right now, I am wearing my Kevin Garnett jersey right now.
What, you're a Celtics fan?
My producer can vouch for that.
Wow.
It's a long story. Anyway, you're right, it's big business, and for an entity like, say, ESPN, the NBA is huge business. I'm sure ESPN's been giving your book a lot of press, a lot of coverage,
yes,
right?
Yes, none whatsoever. It's funny because we know, you know, from the Heat Index, their patented Heat Index, that there are 18 columnists standing by in case LeBron strains himself during a bowel movement. But the book, which was covered by Associated Press, USA Today, Sports Illustrated, Wall Street Journal, on and on, does not exist as far as ESPN is concerned. And the book takes some really vicious swings at ESPN, and I think they're quite aware. It wasn't just the decision. That was simply one more symptom. of their lack of journalistic credibility. They are, in essence, business partners to every major professional and every major college conference. All the leagues are beholden to ESPN. The companies that buy advertising time on ESPN, of course, simultaneously are paying tens and sometimes hundreds of millions of dollars to the athletes that ESPN journalists are supposed to be covering credibly as journalists. So the fact that I, as a crazed, bitter Cleveland fan, wrote about some of this, I understand I can't always have it both ways. I should not expect the worldwide leader to review my book favorably. But to simply act as if such a book does not exist seems, again, like just another symptom of what will eventually, I believe, sink them, which is the belief that you can spout a lot of BS about multi-platform entertainment and sports industry. But meanwhile, I think most sentient sports fans understand this is not a source of credible journalism at all anymore.
Scott Rabb joins us. His book is The Whore of Akron, One Man's Search for the Soul of LeBron James. I'm going to ask the question that most of our listeners are probably wanting me to ask right now, and this is the question. Why? Such a vicious title. Such a cruel title. Why, Scott?
Well, I mean, I'm going to take the question seriously, even though I really think people who belabor the title, it's certainly if it's keeping someone from reading the book, and I've had people say, well, whatever might be inside there is utterly discredited by that title. And I've had various people come at me in various ways about that. I think it's far more lighthearted than people think. And I'm not trying to be clever or coy with you or with anyone else. I think the idea of a writer selling a book about LeBron James while calling him a whore is inherently funny. Anyone who thinks somehow I'm not aware of let's call it irony, but we can also call it hypocrisy or anything else we want. I mean, I've been around a long time, and I am not at all ready to plead anything but no contest to such charges. But it's also, I've had plenty of people say, you know, it's unmanly. It's very unmanly to call someone another man. And I always say, you know, it's really unmanly to worry so much about manliness. You know, to me, and I think the book's a funny book, and I mean ha-ha funny. I think the title and much of what's in the book, and probably much of what I say in answer to your questions, reveals far more about me than it does about LeBron Raymond James. After all, I may have watched him up close and personal for a couple of seasons and paid rapt attention every minute. Doesn't mean I actually know the man. I think most of us barely know ourselves, really. So to me, the title, and look, from my agent's point of view, certainly, and some of my friends, it wasn't the best title in the world, certainly not the most commercial title in the world. I understand that there's offense to be taken. But part of it is also a joke based on Revelations, The Whore of Babylon. Part of it is a little internal homage to one of Woody Allen's great short stories, The Whore of Mensa. And I understand it's not a family-friendly title, and Walmart isn't going to be displaying stacks of it so they can get letters from people going, I was walking with my 8-year-old daughter. How dare you? I get it. But I also, I'm delighted by the title. And I guess that, again, says more about me than it does about LeBron.
I think it's a very funny book. I loved it. There was only one thing in the whole entire book that offended me. Just one thing.
Uh-oh.
And I'll tell you about that in a moment. But I got to tell you, Scott, this is your memoir. You know that. And you've come a long way from rifling vending machines at Case Western, haven't you?
Yeah, I know. Well, look, it was. I didn't have a master plan for the book, obviously, even after the decision. It's not like I sat down and said, here's an opportunity to write a memoir. And even now, I kind of haven't gone back really and read it. And I'm fascinated because I work very carefully on every feature story I've written for Esquire. I work carefully on the small parts, the 200 or 300-word pieces. I generally am the most exacting and obsessive writer in the world. And while I would never say that the book wrote itself, it was a much more organic process in a lot of ways. And I was surprised by what came out. And my mother, for example, was both surprised and appalled and ultimately furious at what came out. So, you know, it was not an intentional act of memoir with LeBron serving in some ways as a vehicle. It became partly a result of me taking seriously questions about how can you wish career-ending injury on a fine young athlete. I don't care what your attachment to the Cleveland teams are. How do you justify such a thing? You know, I took the question seriously, and I also had to ask myself, how did these teams come to loom so large in my life? And those are legitimate questions. But when I sat down to write what I originally thought might be more of a compendium of different Cleveland fans' voices and stories, became more and more memoir-like, and the result is you know, the horror of Akron.
Whenever Gail Collins writes an op-ed piece in the New York Times about Mitt Romney, she always mentions the fact that Mitt once drove around the country with his dog in a cage on top of the car. And whenever you mention Art Modell, the man who took the Cleveland Browns to Baltimore, you say things about him that cannot be said on public radio. The reviewer in Time magazine, that was his big quibble with your book. He loved your book, but he didn't like that fact. I loved it when you talked about Art Modell because it was real, and you were making those feelings known that so many Clevelanders felt when Art Modell took their team away.
Well, you know, there are people who felt it was a real contest. Who is the greater villain in Cleveland sports history, Art Modell or LeBron James? I think most people would answer Art Modell. I myself feel otherwise, but that's neither here nor there. The truth is that out of all that whole litany, the catch, the drive, the fumble, most people don't refer to the move. They're aware that the Browns left Cleveland. I don't think they're necessarily aware of the trauma that inflicted on Cleveland fans. And Art Modell, while he certainly wasn't a native son, he's a Brooklyn-born guy, bought the Browns at a time when they were, if not the Yankees, certainly as close as football had. And over the decades, it's not as if he set out to destroy the team. I think, like most people, he acted in what he felt was his own best interests. And in some ways, he was a model civic citizen for many years. But that ultimate betrayal, taking the Cleveland Browns away from Cleveland, I don't know if the psyches. I've gone to tailgates, and of course the Neo Browns are a clown car of a franchise. They're awful. And what you have there now is a bunch of fans who seem totally dissociated from the sport and from the team, and who simply go to the municipal parking lot before games to get as furiously drunk as quickly as they can. I don't even know how many of them make it to the games. Total disconnect between the town and the team. And that I continue to hold Art Modell responsible for. And to the extent that he became a punching bag in the book, I'm fine with that. If it got tedious for certain reviewers, I'm okay with that too. I'm normally not very aware of readers. It's not some kind of, oh, I'm so aloof. It's simply the less conscious any writer or other artist is of an audience, I think the better off that artist is. I'm not even comfortable saying an artist. Let me just say, when I sit down to write, it's one guy at a keyboard. I'm not thinking about editors. I'm not thinking about readers. But in this case, I was aware that there were a bunch of Cleveland fans who didn't have a book deal. And in some ways, whether I liked it or not, and whether a certain percentage of them read it or not, I was aware that I was speaking for a large group of people who had suffered mightily, including at Art Modell's hands. And so this was a way of enacting my revenge in the only way I know how, which is sitting at a keyboard typing.
The book is The Horror of Akron, One Man's Search for the Soul of LeBron James. Scott Rabb wrote it. He joins us today on the program where he's interrupted an interview with some reporters from Germany who are there eating lunch right now because he wanted to talk to us here on this program, and we really respect and admire him for doing that. After I finished the book, Scott, the first thing I did was I went on Twitter and I subscribed to your Twitter feed. And the second thing I did was I stayed on Twitter and I subscribed to the Twitter feed for King James, which is LeBron James. And I've been really enjoying watching the Twitter feeds. And you had one on the other day that I think you wanted him to read, something about cobbler.
Well, there was a point, it's really chapter 10 of the book, which was one of the strangest nights of my life. He tweeted that night, and it was very, very late. It was actually early in the morning, 2 a.m., about what a great peach cobbler his chef had just prepared. He had a photo of the cobbler. And the cobbler, the peach cobbler in that photo, it had two massive scoops of vanilla ice cream on it. It looked so delectable. And it's not as if LeBron and I were tweeting back and forth, but that cobbler and some medication, literally, went to work on me. And for me, certainly not for LeBron, Cobbler has been kind of a through line. It's kind of, can you hate the sin and love the sinner? Can you be a hater of LeBron and yet love his dessert? The answer, it turns out, for me was yes. So the other night, he again had a photo of dinner. It was Saturday night. I said, where's the cobbler? Saturday night, I need some cobbler, man. It's not as if LeBron answers my tweets.
Yeah.
And I've gotten in trouble tweeting obscenely at LeBron. You know, I've been sober for many years, so I can't even blame alcohol as an excuse, much less my Twitter account was hacked.
Uh-huh.
But Cobbler and I somehow, you know, Cobbler represents some ethereal bond I have with King James. And so when I see him tweeting about food and whatever he's eating that night, I generally will chime in with a Cobbler tweet.
Well, I certainly have been enjoying sort of like a voyeur watching watching this going on. Scott Rabb joins us, and as we get into the Miami section of the book, as you're following him around and trying to get press credentials in Miami, you're almost turning into a stalker, aren't you? Just a little bit?
That's an it's an interesting thing. I think most people, and I'm not suggesting that Vic Mekunis is among them, I'm thinking for some people it's hard to discern the line between reporting and stalking. because I mean, this is what a reporter does. Is a reporter wants to be a fly on the wall, wants to be able to see his subject as often as possible in as many settings as possible without ever actually having to necessarily interact, because that changes everything. So part of the issue with the credentials was that the NBA itself, which issues hundreds if not thousands of credentials to writers and broadcasters for national outfits, you know, to the guys who duct tape ESPN's cables at the games, refused me a credential. Now, I've been a national magazine journalist for 20 years. I profiled many athletes in the different sports leagues, including the NBA. But they refused a credential based on nothing that's actually a rule, based on, well, here's a guy, you know, he's from Cleveland, and he's doing a book with HarperCollins about LeBron James. They weren't comfortable with that. And so they gave me permission to seek single-game credentials from individual teams. Well, it's really not so fair to the Miami Heat media people, whose job is to protect LeBron. So really, it wound up, I looked bad doing it, but all I was trying to do was what any journalist would want to do, which is to be able to see the subject of his work as often and as closely as possible. And at no point, and I know there are plenty of people based on the Twitter feed and all that, who might have thought I was deranged, but I do have a 25-year, million-word-long paper trail as an actual working journalist. So I don't think, too sensitive to the stalker thing, but there was this weird week in November where my one-game credential was all I was going to get because of some tweets, and all of a sudden everyone was talking about how unprofessional I was. And in truth, I was, by today's standards. I came up at a different time. You know, when I'm not saying, I'm not comparing myself to Hunter S. Thompson or the early 70s National Lampoon, but my idea of journalism was not based on the New York Times. It was based on, in my early 20s, reading Rolling Stone and reading the National Lampoon. So to me, there's a huge difference between unprofessional and unethical.
Scott Rabb wrote the book. It's The Whore of Akron, One Man's Search for the Soul of LeBron James. And in the book, you talk about one of LeBron's tattoos, which says loyalty, and you also describe a conversation you had with Chris Rock where you talked about that tattoo, and I thought Chris gave you a really reasonable explanation of what he thought it meant, and it didn't mean loyalty to Cleveland, Ohio, or Northern Ohio, did it?
No, and when you stop and walk back the personal history, LeBron made a decision about high school that wound up leaving in an entire community that he grew up in West Akron feeling betrayed. He went to St. Vincent, St. Mary, you know, almost all Caucasian private school in Akron, instead of Akron Buchtel, the almost all African-American public school. And the people who had already recognized his talent really were outraged by that decision. And I think what Chris Rock pointed out was loyalty to his friends, who are all down in South Beach, by the way, while you and I are having this conversation in December in New York City, freezing our butts off. So, you know, I think Chris Rock pointed out something obvious that a passionate Cleveland fan, if I had ever thought of it before, it was only in the most self-righteous and outraged kind of way. He was right. He was absolutely right.
And you also make the case for the fact that the Miami Heat franchise and that auditorium and the whole scene down there just really doesn't seem to have a soul.
Yeah, I met a lot of nice folks down there and found a lot to like about Miami. But the truth is, where LeBron chose to play, where he chose to, you know, to practice his craft, is a place that really cares very little about their sports teams. The Dolphins have a dedicated fan base. The Heat certainly has its fans, but the truth of the matter is, at Game 6 of the Finals, an elimination game, at least a quarter of the arena was filled with Dallas fans. They were louder than the Miami fans, and almost all of them had purchased their tickets on the team's website. They were seats that were being resold by Heat season ticket holders who would rather have made a few bucks on their season tickets than to have watched their team compete in the NBA Finals. The idea that he left a city where that never, ever could have happened, where people would, you would never have been able to offer them enough money to pass up the chance to see a Cleveland team win a championship, he left there. And he left there feeling good about the decision, at least according to LeBron, in order to play at a place where people really didn't care. And that was an awful, at least poignant. I don't want to overstate it. At some level, yeah, it's sports. It's not famine. It's not pestilence. It's not war. But it felt bad. It felt poignant to me. This is where the kid wanted to play.
The book is The Whore of Akron, One Man's Search for the Soul of LeBron James. Scott Rabb joined us to talk about it today. And I got to tell you, Scott, I laughed. I loved it.
But, Vic, what offended you? You said something offended you in the book.
One thing, Scott, just
fire
one
away.
Thing, okay? I am of Lithuanian descent. You're talking about Z, and you talked about how classy he was when he left Cleveland to go to Miami to rejoin,
yes,
LeBron.
Yes, yes.
And then later on, because of the way he acted and comported himself when he came back to Cleveland for a game, you called him the whore of Kaunas, which is his hometown,
yes,
in Lithuania. I've been there.
Yes.
And that hurt.
You're right. I mean, you're absolutely right. And I, however disingenuous it sounds, I apologize. It is the kind of thing you commit it to print. Unlike the November issue of Esquire, there it is. It's in a book. Was I thinking about it at the time? No, I was making a joke. And I don't want to overstate your pain either, because I know that you like the book and you're a generous reader and an ideal reader and a heck of a guy to spend some time with me today. But yeah, it's not as if that was a thoughtful or measured remark. It was simply a laugh line and a cheap one at that.
I'm over it.
Thanks, Vic.
Scott, thank you.
My pleasure, man.
You've been listening to The Book Nook on WYSO. For The Book Nook, I'm Vic McInnes. Thanks for listening. We have an archive of Book Nook interview podcasts on the WYSO website. Go to the Book Nook page at wyso.org. The Book Nook is recorded at Soundspace in Yellow Springs and engineered by Chris Hertzler.